Good evening, everyone, and thank you all for coming. My name is Michael Feldstein, and I'll be moderating tonight's event on Navigating Through the Dating Maze, which is sponsored by End the Madness. We're very fortunate to have Rabbi Yosef Blau and his wife, Dr. Rivka Blau, discuss various issues of dating and tzedukah in the Orthodox world. First, I'd like to thank the folks at the Mount Sinai Jewish Center for offering to host tonight's symposium. And I'd also like to thank Hananya Weissman, the founder of End the Madness, and Yaakov Schiff and Shira Rose for their assistance in promoting the event. The basic goal of End the Madness is to alleviate the needless stresses and hardships of dating in the observant Jewish community. We aim to accomplish this by expanding the range of available dating options for observant Jewish singles and to give people the confidence to explore the options that are most amenable to them on an individual level. In addition, End the Madness seeks to promote greater achdus by tearing down stereotypes and encouraging observant Jews with different backgrounds and personal customs to consider one another as viable marriage candidates. In the front, when you came in, there were copies of a flyer announcing an upcoming Shabbaton in the Wesley Hills section of Muncie that we're sponsoring in May. You're welcome to take one. We hope you'll join us. Also, if you'd like more information about our organization and some of our activities, please visit endthemadness.org, and that's our website, and you'll find some interesting information there. Now to our speakers. Rabbi Yosef Blau is the Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guidance counselor at REITS and the university's undergraduate schools and colleges for men, a position he's had since 1977. He earned his Bachelor of Arts degree in 1959 from Yeshiva College, a Master of Science degree at the university's Belfer Graduate School of Science in 1960, and he was ordained at Yeshiva University's Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary in 1961. In communal life, Rabbi Blau served as national president of Yavne, the National Religious Students, Jewish Students Association, and is a member of the organization's National Advisory Board. He also served as vice president of the National Conference of Yeshiva Principals, and currently is the president of the Religious Zionists of America. In an age where the culture of fear has unfortunately enveloped the Orthodox community, and many rabbinic leaders are afraid to speak out on important communal issues, Rabbi Blau is a voice of reason, logic, courage, and sanity. Dr. Rivka Blau, an educator and author and Rabbi Blau's wife, has written many essays in popular and academic journals, as well as a biography of her father, Rav Mordechai Teitz, entitled Learn Torah, Love Torah, Live Torah. Her book is both a vibrant history of Jewish life in the 20th century and an argument for Rabbi Teitz's approach, which is to make Torah knowledge accessible to everyone and enjoy within a Torah framework all that is positive in modern life. No doubt, Rivka, that if you were alive today, Rabbi Teitz, your dad, would have something to say about the Shidduch crisis, I'm sure. Dr. Blau has taught Jewish studies and humanities in high school and college and served as principal of two yeshiva high schools. She's on the editorial board of Tradition, a member of the Orthodox Forum. She wrote her doctoral thesis in English and comparative literature at Columbia University on Psalms and English poetry, and is equally adept at quoting a line from John Milton as she is from the Tanakh. I could have used you in my college course, Paradise Lost. Over the last 30 years, Rabbi Blau and his wife, Rivka, have counseled hundreds of YU students about dating and marriage, and they are both extremely qualified to speak about this important subject. On a personal note, I've been privileged to host the Blaus for a Shabbos in the community where I live, which is Stamford, Connecticut, and have remained close with them. They're both wonderful human beings who are sensitive to the needs of singles in our community, and they're not afraid to take an unpopular stand if they feel it is right. Regarding the format for tonight's program, I'm going to be asking Rabbi Blau and Dr. Blau a series of five questions. Both will give a 3 to 5 minute response to each question and then provide some final thoughts. After the formal program is over, we'll take some questions from the audience. Hopefully you've got some index cards, which have been passed out. You'll be able to write down your question. You'll give it to Hananya Weissman here, and we'll try to get as many questions in as we can, but there may be some time constraints, so if your question is not asked, you're welcome to ask Dr. Blau or Rabbi Blau after the program your question yourself. We'll also have refreshments, time to socialize after the program is complete. And for those who would like to daven Maariv afterwards, we'll have a Maariv service in the shul in the back. So, let's begin with our first question. And the first question is there a preferred method of finding gates? Shachanim, online setups, natural meetings, singles events, Shabbatonim. Is one method better than another? What approach should Orthodox singles be taking to the myriad of choices that they have? And I'm going to move the microphone over. No, you can sit. And I'll sit also.
As we're rapidly going to learn, my wife is the practical one, and I'm the one who's going to give some kind of highfalutin theory, which is a nice way of saying it, not like you get a straight answer. The question of what method is most appropriate for young single Orthodox Jews to meet each other brings to mind the two descriptions that the Torah gives of avos and imahos meeting each other and getting married. We're told essentially nothing about how Abraham and Sarah met, but we're told how Yitzchak played a passive role as Abraham sent his Eved Eliezer to find a wife for him, testing the character of Rivka, and then told how Yaakov meets Rachel and immediately falls in love with her. And it always seemed to me that the Torah was telling us that that which is appropriate for one person is not necessarily that which works for another. And if it's true about two of the three of the forefathers and the mothers of our people, it's true in a broader sense for all of us. But beyond that, there really are three questions that have to be asked before we can answer the given question, and I know I have limited time. And that is where we see ourselves in terms of the spectrum of the community. What are we looking for in a spouse? Now, certain methods assume either that the factors that are involved are quantifiable, and it's a matter of finding the proper answer to a series of questions, and the man I want to marry or the woman I want to marry is the one who gives the right answer to all the questions of the values or family background that I have. And others of us are much concerned with the personal interaction and are willing and are perhaps even excited about marrying someone a little bit different. And that's going to be a contrast to ourselves. Don't feel threatened by someone having somewhat different values and seeing it as an opportunity for mutual growth. To some, family background is extremely important. Approval of parents, paramount. And many of us, particularly because I think that most of the young people today go to Israel after high school, go to college away from home, leave their homes at 17. Of course they love their parents, but they play less of a role in the process. So it's impossible to give a single answer of what approach is most appropriate for all kinds of people. It depends on what you're looking for, what your sense of marriage is, what you think is important and less important, How important is attraction? How much are you willing to allow a relationship to develop over time? Now, not having given the answers, but asked a lot of questions, so I will answer the question, none of the above and all of the above.
We're in a bit of agreement here and a bit of disagreement. I think that whatever works is good, but I do have an order for the different possibilities that were given to us, that were presented to us. I think the best way to possibly meet is through friends setting you up, because friends know you well, and friends have an idea of who will be compatible with you. So the greatest chance for success is if a friend is the one who sets you up. Also, the friend has to live with you the next day, so you're sure the friend will be doing her best or his best to set you up as well as possible. I think that the online method of meeting is a wonderful new opportunity for expanding the horizons. And sometimes it's funny that the horizons expand and then they contract again. I'm thinking of somebody who's now the advertisement couple for Firmster, and they're an adorable couple. She's from Switzerland, he's from the United States. And each time that she wanted to go out with people, she knew that in the small city in Switzerland where she was living, there were not too many possibilities. So through Firmster, she would try to set up several dates for when she would come to the United States, and she would come to New York to meet people. And this young man, as it turns out, whom she did marry in the end, Baruch Hashem, his grandmother and her grandmother were best friends when they were growing up as little kids many years ago. But here they met through the computer. So whatever works is good. So if it's through the computer, you may find out that there are all kinds of connections. Usually in the Jewish world, you do find out there are all kinds of connections. And I think there's nothing to be embarrassed about in saying that one met through the computer, because you're able to find out a great deal about each other ahead of time, to see a number of different instances of whether things will work or not. And I think it's a very nice, efficient way of meeting other people. I think that a shatan is the least probable way of meeting the right person, and I know that you'll be surprised to hear this, but how well does the shatan or shatanta, I must say there's a difference, shatan is male, shatanta is female, so I should probably talk about shatanta because it's mostly women who are doing it. How well does the shatanta, or shatanit in Hebrew, how well does she actually know you? And the person who is trying to do a shidduch on a professional basis already has a monetary and vested interest in persuading you to go out with a person again and again. So I'm not sure you're getting the most honest evaluation when you go to somebody who is doing it professionally. I'm not in any way denigrating it. I'm not putting it down. And if somebody who is professional is able to do it, that's great. But I'm just saying, among the possibilities for success, I think that probably is the most limited. And of course, a natural meeting is the best. And I'm not going to try to jump ahead on questions, but let me just say one thing quickly. You said what my father's opponent would have said. My father already, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, 45 years ago, when we got married, thank God, said we ought to be providing more ways for young men and women to meet each other. This is not Europe. This is not a closed society. This is not a place where you can easily get to meet other people. And I worry very much about people who get told when they're in Israel by a Rosh Yeshiva whose children will be vied for because they are a Rosh Yeshiva's children, or by people who will have no trouble getting their kids set up for various reasons, who are living in a closed society in Israel, who send young men and young women back to the United States where it's a very open society. And you come to New York, and who's responsible for you? Who knows you? How could anybody be sure that you're going to be set up with somebody? And I worry about young people being sent back with the idea that somehow it's going to be arranged for you. And that's not the way that it's happening. So I think that what we have to do is realize we're not in Europe, we're not in a close society, we're within your small town or within your general area, you would find people who are compatible. We're in a very big city, we're in a global society now, and I think that what we have to do is create every means of meeting naturally that we can. That's one of the reasons that I ask that the men and women sit mixed on both sides of the aisle and not just one. That's a very nice thing to sit separately if one wants to, but you have to know where that menhag came from and why it became so popular in the United States in the last several decades. At our wedding, my father was very careful not only to have mixed seating, but that at the tables of our friends, he told us to put place cards to make sure that X would meet Y and A would meet B. He said there's no better tofa'ah from a wedding, no better outcome from a wedding than another wedding happening as a result. So I think we have to think about how to create means for natural meeting.
Thank you.
Second question. Is there any value in dating to build socialization skills and maturity before one's ready to get married, as opposed to dating only for marriage? And you can start.
I'll be much shorter this time. Dating is already very marriage focused, so I don't think you can say there's such a thing as going out without some hint of marriage in mind. It has just become impossible to think of dating just for the fun of it. But I do think it's counterproductive if at every moment one is only thinking, is this a person I want to marry? What I would like to see come back into the whole dating situation is a sense of, it's interesting to meet new people, and I'd like to meet new people, and then I'll see out of these new people, is there some possibility of something happening between us? So I would not say just date for the fun of it, because it's not fun to date. It's not fun the way we set things up now. But to enjoy it as much as possible, enjoy meeting new people as much as possible, and then see where that takes you.
The question assumes a certain lack or existing social background. If I can again get philosophic or put it in context, we live in a difficult time. I say difficult, but all times are difficult. But I have a specific aspect. For many of the young people today, at least the young people that I deal with, they were brought up until 17 or 18 in a certain environment with a certain set of social approaches, certain notion of what's doable, what's acceptable, and what's not. They go off to Israel, enter a totally different world with different values. They come back to the state and are confused. And enter into a situation which is neither the first nor the second. In contrast to people in earlier times, where whether the system was a good system or not, at least was relatively consistent. The way they were brought up is the way they lived. It's not true now. It's not true that we live the same set of values that our parents have. Which means that for some people, before they start dating, have already had, under many contexts, a lot of social interaction with people of the other sex. And therefore, dating for them becomes a process to translate that into finding someone as a spouse. There are others who have been in a single-sex environment their entire lives, or have rejected their high school experiences and have no longer find them acceptable, and therefore they are going to be uncomfortable in the social interactions, which makes the dating process even more daunting and more difficult, because there's so much weight attached to it, because they're not allowed to talk to somebody of the sex if they're not formally dating to get married. Now, I personally think that that's a bit of a mishigas, and an exaggerated position that's probably appropriate in the Hasidic world, but certainly not the people who live in our world. I find it always strange that there are people who are very concerned they're never having mixing at all, and yet they expect to go out in the workforce and work in an office where they're going to mix with Jews and non-Jews of both sexes all day long, 8 hours a day, and somehow they go back as if, you know, that didn't really happen, and they're going to go back to this. So for people who have limited social exposure to people of the other sex, then I think it's definitely valuable for them to go out, even if they don't think it's going to lead to marriage, just to calm down a little bit, get to know people. Though I agree with my wife that it's much better for them to do that in a more natural setting than with all the pressure associated with dating.
Thank you. Next question. What's with the artificial rules that we have set up, such as where someone must go out on a date, how many dates are required before an engagement or breaking up, dating only one person at a time? Is there any halakhic basis for these kinds of rules? And what can we do as individuals and as a community to eliminate some of these constraints? Rabbi Blau.
Well, it's clear that the people who made up these questions already have a desired answer on this one. Artificial rules, how can you break them? I happen to agree with the questioner, by the way. I don't know of any halakhic basis to any of these things, that you go out X number of times. The only halakhic basis I know is that the Gemara says you're not allowed to marry a spouse that you haven't seen before. But that's rather minimal. Beyond that, this is all made up. I don't know who made them up. I made up rather recently. And are totally arbitrary. And are just simply sources of pressure on people. Certainly not people who went out only a handful of times and decided they were the right person. And other people who spent a year going out before they were comfortable that this was the right choice. It doesn't make one right and the other wrong. Each person is different and each relationship is different. The best thing would be if we could get an agreement to tear up all these rules and just drop them. They don't serve essentially any real purpose. And I don't know, as I said, I don't know where they came from. They certainly didn't exist when we met before I got married. And if they make some sense in some communities, where they reflect something about that community, then so be it. Except these are not the communities that I think most of the people in this room belong to, so I think they should be essentially irrelevant to you. And it would help that I would make a public announcement that I am, in my rabbinic capacity, I was mevatel, like chametz. I said that all these rules no longer exist. I'll be happy to do so. I am not so sure that it'll have any impact.
I think the major rule is don't hurt the other person. Just consider the other person's feelings. That's the major rule. And if you're going out with someone who tells you that he thinks that after three times or four times, or that she thinks after three times or four times, this means that things are getting very serious, if you don't agree with that, you just have to speak clearly right from the start. And you can say, look, I believe in getting to know each other, and I don't want to feel that if we go out another time, that I'm saying much more than I intend to say. Speaking clearly and consideration for the other's feelings, I think, are the two major credos to follow here, two major ways to follow here. I will say that the one rule that I find is very, very bothersome and makes it very expensive in time is the rule of not meeting two new people at the same time. I understand if one is going out with a person, then it's not appropriate if you're going out with somebody three, four, five times. It's not appropriate to see another person between just to check. That's not a fair thing to do. Unless you and the person you're going out with agree that you will still be possibly trying to meet other people, that you've made no commitment to each other. But if it's new people meeting for the first time, I don't understand why it can't be two people that you meet in 1 week. And I'm talking from very recent experience. I do try as much as I can to try to help people meet each other, and I am thrilled that Baruch Hashem, the six couples that I set up over 40 years' time, are all still talking to me. So that's a good sign for Rosh Hashanah. There's six happy marriages, thank God.
Are they talking to each other, though?
They're close together. But I've just been working for 2 months to try to set someone up with a particularly young man. And finally, he agreed to go out. I will say that it does make me feel a little funny that so many young men, regardless of trepidation, getting a phone call from me, what am I doing? I'm just trying to suggest that you meet someone. But you can hear the defensiveness in their voice right away when I say that I'd like them to meet someone. But I finally got the young man to agree. When I called the young woman, somebody's coming in next week to New York, especially to meet her. And she felt it was wrong to meet somebody this week if she's meeting somebody next week. And I just felt, I'm not going to hold anybody to doing anything that they think is wrong. But now we have to wait until this, so good. We now have to wait until this young man and the young woman have gone out and is going to be here for a full week before she can decide whether she wants to meet the person that I've been working for 2 months to get her to meet. So I know that the doctor principle is working all the time, and that doctor, when I would finally get him to agree, I could expect that she would say no, not now. But it can get a little discouraging. And I think of so many people that I know who even went out with two different people in one day that they were meeting for the first time. And it was because they were down with two people in one day that they had a basis for comparison and contrast and could say, wow, this person, it was just such a different experience going out with her from going out with the other person, and therefore have a basis on which to make a decision which one to go out with further. So that's the one rule I would really like to ask people to question. I'm not saying if you're going out seriously over a period of time that one should then meet other people at the same time, and what does that mean to your commitment to the relationship? But if it's the first time, it should be considered.
Well said. Next question. Has the increased separateness of the sexes in the Orthodox world contributed to a problem where we have a generation of young adults who is now dating with poor socialization skills? And should there be more opportunity for high school and college students to interact, even if classes are not co-educational, even if people are going to separate sex schools? Let's start.
I won't talk about co-education or single-sex education because that's something that we have to have both available in the community. People have to find a school that's right for them. I don't think the fact that people are going to single-sex schools is what's creating poor social skills. I think we have to really concentrate on a number of things that our Chacham told us over the years, including what's unpleasant to you, don't do to the other person. I think what Hillel began with is the main thing that we have to think about relationships with each other. That's the biggest social skill, just being a mensch to the other person. So I'm not worried about dating skills. A person can pick that up. I think that what we're concerned about is we're so aware of the chukoseyam lo selechum, and we're so aware of the fact that the non-Jewish world at this point has really gone into an interesting universe where people are bodies, they don't have souls, they don't have minds, they're bodies, and it's just a matter of bodies meeting each other and interacting with each other. So I think because we're surrounded by a world that is so sexually preoccupied, it makes it a little harder for us to think of ways to say that young men and young women should be able to meet each other and should be able to interact with each other and trust to the Torah training that people will behave themselves properly. So I don't think that the separate schools have contributed to the problems we have now, but I think that we do have to think of ways for people to, this is what I said in the first question also, so I guess this is what my mind is on. We have to think of how people can meet each other in a refined, beautiful Torah atmosphere. My husband and I met at a shir, and it was after the shir that a friend introduced us to each other, and I think that was about the nicest way to meet. And at that shir, three other couples were introduced who married each other. It was a very productive shir.
I also don't see the critical question whether single-sex or co-ed schools, which are questions in many other areas and many other ramifications. But I do see as a fundamental problem is I think that we are sending And that's a problem of not of your generation, but of mine and the educators. We're sending very different messages to young men and to young women in the Orthodox community, and therefore creating tremendously contrasting expectations. We have a situation where essentially all the young women in the community that we're talking about are certainly college graduates. Almost all of them assume that they're going to be working in a meaningful way, often as professionals, which is going to have many consequences in terms of the time they're going to have and where they're going to live married lives. And we have the young men basically told that, you know, you're the head of the household and you're in charge, and your wife should be number two, and supportive of all the things you're going to be doing. It doesn't mix. When you send conflicting messages, then of course you're going to have socialization problems, because people have very different expectations. Now granted, I'm very much influenced by what happens at Yeshiva in Stern, which is not the entire world. Though some people on one side of Washington Heights seem to think it is. But I endlessly reinforce the notion when I get a chance to speak at Stern, and I'm at Yeshiva most of the vast majority of the time, how the very same brother sister institutions are sending such contrasting messages to students. So I'm not surprised that people are confused, right? You can't stop that problem, very frankly. It's not the hands of young people to really change that. But it's important to realize that you may be having a message about what you think the person the other sex is going to be like, and what their role in marriage is going to be when they have gotten a very contrasting and different message. And so maybe your responsibility to communicate with each other, and certainly not to assume that one message is the right one and the other one is wrong. There are many ways of developing social skills for people who attend single-sex schools to meet under another context.
Thank you. What are some ideas that you can think of to make dating a little bit more productive and less painful and more enjoyable for people who are in the dating world?
Well, I mentioned before that the first thing is to just think of this as an opportunity to meet another interesting person. And I have to tell you, from the vantage point of being a number of decades older, or than most of the people in this audience, that a lot of the people that you meet before you're 30, you're going to meet again and again and again in life. So just try to make it as pleasant an experience as you can. And try to be as pleasant as you can, and try to regard it as this is all a way of meeting new people. I would wish, I mentioned already the idea of seeing at weddings as a very appropriate place for people to meet each other. There's something that used to happen, I was told, at Breuer's in the Good Dominion in the 1940s and the 1950s, that was stopped later on, but was a wonderful way of people meeting each other. It seems that the Good Dominion used to have shal shudas for young men and young women together, and they would have long rectangular tables. The young women were sitting on one side, the young women were sitting on the other side. It was just a nice way to meet for 45 minutes over a light meal and a Dvar Torah, and that a number of shidduchim resulted from those shal shudas meals. I think we have to think of things like that, where it's just an easy, natural, spontaneous way, and not the very time-consuming way of meeting one person at a time on an arranged date. This way, you can get to talk with four or five people who are there at the table, and people just get to know each other with much less pressure.
That's just one example I thought of, and it's something that was done here in this community until about 50 years ago, and then was stopped. And am I right about this? Did you hear about this also? Or maybe you're too young to know about it. Okay. But I was told by other members of the community that this is what used to go on. We have to think of ways for people to be meeting each other. The main thing I would say is one's life is not on hold. I'll tell you from another experience. I had a doctoral thesis hanging over my head for 17 years. For 16 years it was hanging over my head, and in 9 months' time it got done. And when I think to myself, during those years, there were so many Sundays when I really could not enjoy reading the New York Times because I would think, I really should be doing something else. I should be working on that. I won't say what expletives could have crossed my mind, thesis. And I would say, you're living your life. You want something to happen in your life. If it's a chef, it will. But meanwhile, you want to enjoy your life as much as you can. And the more you do that you enjoy, the more of a person who conveys that excitement about life, that vitality, the more you are that kind of person, the better life you'll be leading, and the more you can enjoy things while going through this very challenging period.
During the day, I work in yeshiva, so one of the things that I tend to do is when eating lunch at the cafeteria, finding a table that has one empty seat and four or five boys sitting together, and just sitting down asking if they mind my joining them at the meal. And I find it always fascinating. I learn new things, and I've been doing this for a while. But what I find quite disappointing is that invariably all the boys sitting at the table either went to the same yeshiva in Israel, or they went to high school together, or they were in the same shir in the yeshiva, and that even within the small world of YU, while eating lunch, the opportunity of meeting someone with a slightly different background with slightly different experiences is not taken advantage of. Now, what does it have to do with dating? It has a great deal to do with it. Because if one's attitude towards meeting new people is not a positive one, if one sees it as threatening somehow to the purity of whatever message one has gotten from someplace, one's endlessly filled with fear of finding about somebody different, then dating is going to be brutal. It can't be enjoyable. Because there's no way that you're going to find someone, from the opposite sex who's just like you and has the same background, fits exactly. We have to change the mentality. And the mentality should be to recognize that we live in a community that has managed to differentiate itself into a lot of very small slices. And I'm not just referring to the fact that some communities are yeshivish and some are Hasidic and some are YU. I now have learned that there's a big difference in yeshiva whether you come from the five towns of Teaneck, even though they're all YU communities. I mean, different kinds of YU communities. And it's about time that we allow for differences. And we recognize the world will not come to an end if someone has slightly different hashgachas. Now I realize it's a potential problem if we don't straighten out before we get married which yeshiva our children go to after high school. But since I believe we should live in a world where people grow and change, I hope that which we are thinking now will probably not be what we'll be thinking 15 years from now anyway. But bottom line, the only way dating will be more productive and more enjoyable is if the perspective is that I have an opportunity to meet someone interesting, that I was told by someone who suggested it, or someone where I met them at an event that indicated that people have shared the values that I have, we went to Ukraine together for YWSSR, we did something together, getting commonality of interest, of concerns. They're interesting, and I will grow from meeting them. But if it's always going to be, I'm set up with this person, I hope it's the right person to marry, but we know about vast majority of times it's not going to be, it's only going to be one right person, then it's going to be a burden, and it's going to be deadening, you know, and you're going to go back and then go over everything to see, you know, she said this, or he said that, you know, and that. Let's broaden our horizons, and then we have at least a chance that the dating experience will be part of our growth in exposure and experiencing other people, which will, in its own way, lead to find someone to marry. And by the way, the goal is not to get married, it's to have a meaningful and a growing life, an enjoyable life together after you get married as well.
With regards to dating, Dr. Scott Goldberg, who spoke at a previous End the Madness Symposium, had some wise words to say about a first date. I think a lot of people go into a first date trying to figure out whether that person is going to be the person they want to spend the rest of their life together. And Scott said that the only purpose of a first date is to figure out whether you want to go out on a second date. And I think that's really very smart. It's something to think about when you're going out on first dates. We're going to wrap up with some final thoughts, and then we'll take some questions from the audience.
Your wife wants to have the last word.
Yes. I don't have a final thought. This is all a process.
The magic word, process. It's easier for us to tell you to loosen up than it is for you. But really, that is my final word, you know. Yes, people should be serious, but not absurdly so. There's so much that we don't know about life, and so much that's not predictable, that even if we check off on every list that exists, and we make sure of total compatibility on everything under the sun, and they pass the height, weight, looks, test, doesn't really mean anything. The Rav says in Family Redeemed that every decision to get married is irrational because you have to take a risk because you can't predict. You know, in the non-Jewish world, there are a lot of people who live together before they get married. Their divorce rate is not any lower than those who didn't, even though they've lived together for years. Doesn't matter. It's different. A little trust in each other. A little trust in Baruch Shalom. And openness. And I think we may get a little bit better results than we're getting up from that.
I think our panelists both deserve a big round of applause. First question. In my mother and father's day, there were an absolutely working need for each other. Today, young people with are generally financially independent. What is the need young people will require for a lasting relationship?
I really recommend reading Family Redeemed because Rav Soloveitchik has many interesting thoughts about these kinds of topics. He mentions that the purpose of marriage is to stop the loneliness of not being married, and that marriage is for companionship, marriage is for the complete trust that you have with another person, the complete commitment that you have to each other, and ultimately the way to make that commitment as whole as possible and building a new unit is to have a child together. So I don't think it's just financial. Marriage is much more than that. As an emotional, a spiritual, a complete relationship. It's not just body, it's also soul. And it's not just finances, it's thoughts, it's feelings. And I think that, in fact, I had a feeling that there might be a question like this, even though it was not in the official list that you gave us. And I just wrote down a quote from Russell Leach, if I can find it quickly enough, I'll just read it, because it's so beautifully said. The cause of marriage is the exasperating and desperate feeling of loneliness. The goal of marriage is the redeeming experience of life and fellowship. And I can tell you that if there are differences between the couple, we learned from my parents a very easy way to settle them. For example, in my family, we thought that every zemer that we sing on Shabbos and Yom Tov has to have at least two or three tunes to it. Because my father liked the tunes from his family, my mother liked the tunes from her family. So we just learned that every stanza you sang a different tune, and you got all the tunes in. So it's that fellowship out of the differences to create that harmony together.
Luckily, I can't sing, so I have to edit to four rather than two melodies for each demo. There have been many opinions about what marriage means in Jewish life. I've never seen one before that said it was a commercial arrangement, because it's good for business. I think that reflects, the great question reflects the fact that there are a lot of singles now in the community. And people are not out to be miserable. And they make something good out of their condition. And I don't join those who say, we'll make all the singles so miserable that they won't get married. There's something clearly missing from one's life if one doesn't have someone to share it with. And one is not involved as well in the process of creating a family. I separated the two. One is the sharing, and the sharing is most meaningful with someone who is different. Not with someone who's a copy. And the opportunity to create a family and to be creative in that way together is something that's most remarkable. It's one of the most exciting, even though complicated and difficult things someone can do in life. And I certainly know that bringing up children is not easy, and children having parents isn't easy either.
That's the only way.
But I haven't found it out. But be careful today, we will find a surrogate mother who might not get out. But the family which has one parent of each sex, I still think is probably the best way to go. Don't think about the money. And if you're really that commercial, then two salaries should be better than one. Remember, you won't pay double the rent for a couple that you have, and it's probably even financially worthwhile, too.
References. How laudable is the practice of asking for references? Is it important to ask for references before or during going out with someone?
You can ask for references or not ask for references, whatever your modus operandi, whatever way you prefer to do things. Ultimately, you're trying to get to know another person, and only Hashem really knows another person. We just get an inkling of who the other person is. I don't think references can make that much difference. Sometimes the references could be sterling, but the person himself or herself turns out to be a very difficult, complex personality, and the people on the outside didn't know what they were saying when they said what they said. It's not a simple business. What you're trying to do is get to know another person, and my husband already quoted my favorite insight from Family Redeemed. You're taking a chance. You're making an emotional, spiritual, psychological, physical, and financial commitment to another person that you don't really know well, and you won't really, really know well until way into the marriage. You're just trying to make the best guess that you can. If the references help you make the best guess that you can, then go for that. It was a joke in my family that my father turned to me after my husband and I were married for 20 years and he told me, you know, he's really a very loyal man. And I said to my father, it took you 20 years to realize that. And my father said, but after 20 years, you really see it. And you really see what a loyal person he is. And that's it. You don't really know another person until you've had a lot of interactions with that person.
I don't mean to play games, we have to define references. If you're talking about your friend said, I went out with this young lady, or I went out with this young man, and he wasn't for me, but he may be good for you, because I think you'll hit it off, that's perfectly fine. That's a great reference. If you're saying, I'm going to call up all the person's teachers and parents and second cousins to find out all kinds of things, that's ridiculous. I unfortunately don't share my wife's success in making shidduchim, but I do get involved along the way many times, and I understand because I get calls from parents all the time. They want to know about a young man or a young woman that their son or daughter is going out with simply because they're in California and the children are in New York and they're getting nervous because they don't know anything and they're not going to fly somewhere to California unless there's something really going on and then it's really late in the game. But even then, it's just to reassure them that, you know, their poor child isn't being taken in by some, person who can put on a false image and fool everybody in the world. Unfortunately, in general, when people give references lie anyway, so it might as well forget about playing the game. If you live in those circles and if you're a young woman, it's really remarkable that every boy you've got out with is in the best boy in his yeshiva. And they all go to the same yeshiva, that's maybe even more
important. Couple of questions here. Do you think that there's one right person for everyone that there may be multiple people want to marry and be happy with? That's question number one. And the second question is, do you think people who want to make aliyah should only date people who also want to make aliyah?
Yeah. On the question of more than one right person, I learned this from my grandmother, Aleha Shalom, when I found out when I was already a teenager that my grandfather had been previously married to a young woman who had unfortunately died of childbirth and the child had died also at that time. And how did I find out? There were people who used to visit us, and I just couldn't tell exactly what they were. They weren't quite relatives, but they seemed to know a lot about our family and to feel like relatives. It turned out that they were the family of that first wife. And the only memory left of her after my grandfather passed away was that my grandmother knew about her. And this was their way of kind of keeping the memory alive. And I remember saying to my grandmother, buddy, how can you be friendly with them? After all, Zadie was married to somebody else before you. And my grandmother told me something very, very profound. She said, you can love more than one person in life. She was right for that period of his life, and she was very good to him. And I was right for the next period of his life, and I tried to be very good to him also. And that was a very, very big lesson. And I can tell you that people will be very glad to tell you when you are getting married or if you are married about all the people that your spouse went out with beforehand. And if this is going to make you feel jealous, or make you feel underconfident, or make you feel uncomfortable, just remember my grandmother's insight. You can love more than one person.
Aliyah.
I'll let my husband answer that.
Good.
Okay.
I'll start with the same question. Just point out that we'll never know. And therefore, the question is essentially meaningless. If you find someone, it's the only unfortunate drive to the question is if you are convinced that there's only one right person, then you're going to endlessly worry that you found the right one. And therefore it's going to, you know, inhibit you by saying, well, maybe there's someone a little bit better than me, and this is only second best. We'll never know. At some point, in a relationship, we'll feel something about someone, and we'll feel both an attraction and a sense that this is a good relationship, and it will be. So, is it possible? You know, I also have that it could have been someone else. I never understood people who worry about not meeting their bashev. It seems to be a contradiction in terms. If there are bashev, that's the one we're going to meet. That's what bashev means. Let's calm down about this one. On the second question, if people plan on going on Aliyah, I don't think they should be going out with people who reject it totally. To make anything a litmus test is probably a mistake, because we never know where we're going to end up and what's going to happen.
Speaking from experience, I think marriage is all about compromise, and I know there were a lot of people who swore they were going to be making Aliyah and only date people who were making Aliyah, and then after a period of time they realized that there are certain things they may be willing to compromise on, other things you're not willing to compromise on. So I think it really depends on, you know, how strongly you feel about the issue. How important is difference in age in dating? And should you say no to someone due to their age?
It's just as important as the feeling of the person involved. There are happy marriages of people who are 11 years apart from each other. There are happy marriages where the man is younger than the woman. There are all kinds of happy marriages with various age disparities. It's just a matter of whether the couple is comfortable with it. I'm going to quote you on something that my husband has mentioned. That it used to be when people got married in their middle teens, when life expectancy was much lower, that it did matter that the man should be slightly older than the woman, because all studies prove that young women do mature faster than men. So a 17-year-old man is appropriate for a 15-year-old woman. But now that we're marrying in our 30s, as my husband has pointed out, by that time all those differences in maturity have ironed out. And my husband mentioned that if we're talking about life expectancy, since women live longer than men, it's really smarter now for the women to be older when they marry.
Is there anybody I can add anything to me to quote my wife? at this point. And I don't really have a sharp quote to add. Again, arbitrary rules are ridiculous. A difference is a difference if it's a difference, right? If the difference in age is such a difference in life experience that the people can't interact effectively, then that's obviously not the right person, but not because the age is different, but because they don't interact well. If they can interact well and they're not the same age, that's fine.
Any special considerations to previously married persons seeking to get remarried and stay married?
The first thing is that the people who were married and the marriage didn't work shouldn't berate themselves. Should think that undoubtedly they're a failure because they had an unsuccessful marriage. There are endless reasons why marriages don't succeed. If the Torah thought that divorce was not acceptable, we wouldn't have a gittin. We wouldn't have a concept of divorce. There's a scholar in Israel, Professor Stamfer, who's made a study of 19th century Eastern European Jewry and discovered that the divorce rate was very high, maybe more than a third. The marriage, whatever the explanation for it, the notion that no one ever got divorced before, and this is true only in our time and it's a sign of the destruction of society, is one of these myths that are perpetrated. If one has gotten married to the wrong person, to thank God one has gotten out before one is overburdened by an unpleasant relationship. to be married, because they feel the weight of the decision simply because no one wants to make a mistake twice. Ben has to make a mistake once, even if that one's fault, one always thinks that it's one has made a mistake. It's one of the things that happens to people in life. And then we move on, and you know, sometimes second marriages are much better than the first one.
If you find that the person is a very fine person, and a person that you get to know him or her, you really care for and respect and see as a wonderful person, I think one should go with one's own feeling about this. Because what I have seen in second marriages is the person who's been through an unhappy or even a tragic experience is so appreciative of a spouse who is normal and loving and ready to make a good marriage, that if anything, the divorced person may prove to be an exceptionally good spouse. They have such an appreciation for a good marriage.
Thank you. I do want to wrap things up. This will be the last question. If we didn't get to your question, please feel free to speak to either Rabbi Blau or Dr. Blau after the program. They will stay around a little bit so that they can hopefully answer your question. You talked about more natural settings when meeting members of the opposite sex. How do you keep things natural when there's always a subtext of marriage? And how do you just kind of go with the flow in these more natural settings?
An excellent question. Just try to concentrate on what the natural setting is, be it a cheer, be it a food drive, be it a visit to a nursing home, whatever it is, there is a function going on, there is something happening, and just try to, as I said, enjoy life as it is, and let it flow from there. Let me think more while my husband answers.
I hope this doesn't have to be a long answer. Hopefully you were able to keep two things in our mind at the same time. Right? So we can have something in the forefront of our mind and something in the back of our mind. So if we go, you know, we participate in a program because we think it's a good program to go to. And yes, in the back of our mind we might meet the right person, but that shouldn't be a dominant thing. That should be a secondary thing. We're going to have it, and if we get an additional benefit, great. And if we don't get additional benefit, it's not a disaster, because we did something we thought was meaningful, and we went to something we enjoyed. Anyway, and the truth of the matter is, even sometimes not meeting the right person doesn't mean we didn't grow, even in that area, from the experience. So I could make it longer.
Again, I don't have a final word. I just wish that everyone should find his and her happiness to be such a...
Amazing. I'd like to call on Anya Weissman for some brief closing remarks, and then everyone is free to enjoy some of the refreshments and speak to the last.
They can speak to each other, too.
And to each other.
Thank you both to Rabbi Blau and Dr. Blau. The only remark that I have is an invitation for people to get more involved with End of Madness. There was a lot of talk about having more opportunities for people to meet. This is one of the things that we at End of Madness are always trying to do, and we would love to have more quality people helping us out. So if you'd like to join us, you can speak to me or Michael Felton after the program. Thank you.
Okay. It was really good. Thank you for participating. Yeah, there were some good questions. I'm glad you cleaned it. Yeah, that's a nice program.
Good night. Good night.